lot of President Trump's behavior did come off as transactional. So I think the assessment is mixed at the end of the day.
President Trump hails Asia trip as a success. It's Wednesday, November 15th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. We're on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, what's in a name? Trump uses new regional term. Australian same-sex survey results to be revealed. The latest in Asia business, preventing stillbirths and a self-charging battery. It's all on today's VOA Asia. President Donald Trump has declared his 12-day, five-nation Asia trip a success. En route back to Washington Tuesday, Mr. Trump said he made a lot of great friends and suggested the United States will no longer be taken advantage of on trade. He predicted that relationships will be fair and reciprocal. The president, without elaborating, said the United States sold $300 billion in equipment and other things and expected that a number to be quadrupled quickly. The Washington Post said Mr. Trump's trip was designed to offer a vision for U.S. foreign policy and reassure allies at a time of tension involving North Korea and the South China Sea. The paper's analysis said Mr. Trump's offered conflicting versions of his Asia policy. Associate editor Ankit Panda, the Asia-Pacific publication The Diplomat, tells VOA's Victor Beatty he views the trip as having mixed results.
We saw the president deliver an address in Vietnam, for example, around a theme of a free and open Asia-Pacific, which is what the administration is effectively calling its broader strategic outlook towards the Asia-Pacific. Additionally, we saw the first ever meeting at a fairly low level, at the working group level of the Quadrilateral Initiative after 10 years. This was a meeting of diplomats from Japan, the United States, India, and Australia, forming a sort of concert of democracies. Of like-minded states that value the same things in the Asia-Pacific. That said, I think there is also something to be said for the broader undiplomatic insults that we saw levied against Kim Jong-un, and also a broader absence of normative issues, including human rights and values, which didn't feature too prominently, even in Japan and South Korea, where I would say President Trump was moderately successful in reassuring these allies. We saw very little sense of a democratic solidarity or solidarity with these allies in the context of the alliance. A lot of President Trump's behavior did come off as transactional. So I think the assessment is mixed at the end of the day.
Does that give China an opportunity? One analyst said Trump is a godsend for China's rise.
There has been a lot of analysis that I think has treated this as a gift for China, the fact that the United States appears to be a little bit adrift. I wouldn't go that far. I think the Chinese did succeed in flattering President Trump in a way that resulted in a fairly smooth visit for him in Beijing, where uncomfortable issues ranging from the South China Sea to North Korea to the trade imbalance didn't get the kind of attention that many observers had hoped for. That said, I think China remains unable to fully capitalize so far on what appears to be United States adrift. Beijing's rhetoric and Beijing's actions continue to demonstrate a degree of divergence. We see some reports treating President Xi Jinping's statements on free and open trade, which China claims to support. Effectively, we see those words being taken for granted without a broader scrutiny of Chinese trade and investment practices. So it's far from clear that the Chinese will be able to benefit from this trip in the way that some observers have suggested. But certainly, as far as the comparative differences go between the U.S. and China, I think China will have something to gain here.
Ankit Panda said Mr. Trump's message to leaders of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation meeting in Vietnam represented a clear divergence from previous U.S. administrations, that the United States is prepared to go its own way on trade by cutting bilateral deals. APEC, he said, is designed to pursue liberalized multilateral trade, representing a bit of retrenchment. He described the trip as, overall, a success simply because it didn't fail. He said the president showed great stamina and did succeed in reassuring Japan and South Korea regarding the North Korean threat. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Expectations high for Secretary of State to press Myanmar on Rohingya crisis. Indonesians allowed to officially identify with indigenous faiths. Canada's Trudeau raises human rights with Philippines Duterte. Indian city rounds up beggars ahead of visit by Ivanka Trump. Detained U.S. basketball players returning home from China. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. During his first presidential trip to Asia, Donald Trump developed a sudden affinity for the phrase Indo-Pacific, not Asia or Asia-Pacific, as had been the term used by many referring to the area. Does Indo-Pacific give some insight into how the United States views the region? Well, to get an answer to that question, VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Murray Hebert, a senior associate of the Southeast Asia program at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies. He asked Hebert what this change means.
Well, we're all trying busily to understand it. Obviously, one thing it means is that it is, you know, we've often, traditionally, we've talked about the Asia-Pacific. By doing the Indo-Pacific, it's a clear reference to the fact that U.S. wants to connect the Pacific and Indian Ocean so that India and South Asia are included in the broad sweep of Asia. So it was also initially unfurled, I guess, at a speech that Secretary Tillerson gave just before Trump's visit. Tillerson was off to India, and when he started to use this term, and really made it very clear that it was going to be an effort to draw India more into the Asia deliberations. That some of it seemed like he highly lauded India, criticized China a lot, which made it suggested that it might be an effort for the U.S. to work with India and probably some other countries like Japan and Australia to provide a check or a hedge against China.
What does the inclusion or what does the addition of India mean to the whole geopolitical structure of this all?
Well, obviously, India is a very big country, like China, you know, well over a billion people. But India has been relatively underrepresented in the rest of Asia. It is not, for example, a member of the APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Community, which Mr. Trump just attended in Vietnam. India has been a much smaller economic partner, smaller trading partner. And I think so. This is an attempt to draw India more into the growth and dynamism of the rest of Asia. The Japanese, Australians, Indians, and Americans met at a senior official level to start figuring out how they could cooperate more. They call them the Quad for short. How they could cooperate to have greater influence in the region. But again, that was also relatively undefined.
What does this mean for China as far as what we understand so far of this concept?
President Trump didn't allude too much to China, but Secretary Tillerson did and talked about how democratic countries live by the rule of law. He criticized China for, you know, not respecting intellectual property rights, for stealing technology, for forcing technology transfers, some of those concerns, as well as alluded to China's more assertive behavior in the South China Sea, and talked, Secretary Tillerson used the words predatory when referring to some of China's policies, which attracted a lot of attention. So, I think we're going to, you know, again, this is another aspect that we were going to have to sort of watch as it evolves over the next few months.
What's been China's reaction so far?
They have not said a lot, but some of the reaction has been that we don't see this as aimed at us. So they don't see it as targeted at them. So I think you would expect China probably to downplay it, at least initially, until they see how the free and open Indo-Pacific is implemented.
Why would President Trump continue to use the phrase if no one seems to know what it means yet?
Well, I guess they're looking for like a bumper sticker kind of a slogan that that you can use to describe the policy. You remember President Obama used the words initially a pivot to Asia and then the rebalance to Asia. Obviously, President Trump wants to change those policies and certainly have changed the name. I think it's, and I alluded to those other policies of the President Obama because it took a while for them to put meat on the bones so that people could figure out what the content was. So I think this is going to be very much a work in progress as they try to spell out in greater detail what it means.
Murray Hebert is a senior associate of the Southeast Asia program at the Washington Bay Center for Strategic and International Studies. Murray, thanks so much for trying to explain this.
Thanks. You're welcome.
Happening now in Asia, a report by Myanmar's military issued in anticipation of a visit by U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says an internal investigation found no evidence that its soldiers committed human rights violations against ethnic Rohingya Muslims. International human rights organizations quickly denounced the report. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. You've joined us for VOA Asia, and we're happy you're here. Thanks for listening. Australia's same-sex marriage postal survey has closed. The official results are expected later today. Voters were asked if the Marriage Act should be changed to allow same-sex couples to wed. From Sydney, Phil Mercer tells us polls are suggesting a win for the Yes campaign, although the result is not legally binding on Parliament.
16 million Australians were eligible to vote in Australia's same-sex marriage postal survey. Officials say almost 80% of the potential voters responded, and opinion polls are predicting a win for the Yes campaign. The debate has at times been fractious and divisive. There have been accusations of bullying and bigotry on both sides of the argument. Yes campaigners say they've been called perverts, while a church backing the No campaign has been sprayed with obscene graffiti. The government pleaded for the debate to be civil and respectful, and the Senate, the Australian Parliament's upper chamber, went a step further. It passed special legislation that banned intimidation, threats and vilification during the vote. Magda Szabanski, an Australian actor and marriage equality advocate, says she's been subjected to vile homophobia.
I can match you and then some for the abuse that I've received and many people in the Yes campaign for years. I mean, get AIDS and die pervert, you're a paedophile. It has been very nasty on the extremes, and generally we don't give air to that, but I do feel I have to correct this lopsided perception that the Yes are bullies. I really think that's not fair.
The Yes campaign hopes the postal votes will help to make Australia fairer and more inclusive. The Anti-Reform Coalition for Marriage says that should same-sex couples be allowed to tie the knot, there'd be serious consequences for children. It insists that students would be exposed to radical views on homosexuality in schools. The postal survey result will be released by the Australian Bureau of Statistics, which organised the ballot. The result isn't legally binding, but Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, who's a supporter of reform, has promised to introduce same-sex marriage legislation by the end of the year if Australians vote yes. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on The Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia, three American college basketball players detained in China on shoplifting charges are on their way home after President Donald Trump asked his Chinese counterpart to personally intervene in the case. Trump brought up the matter of the UCLA players in talks with Xi Jinping during his visit to Beijing last week. Stop by VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, on today's business scene, a big Asia trade deal remains alive and a huge day for Chinese e-commerce.
This is Business Scene. I'm Skylar Ogden. 11 countries in the Trans-Pacific Partnership have agreed to move forward with the trade deal despite the withdrawal of the United States. U.S. President Donald Trump reiterated his America First position last weekend at the APEC summit in Da Nang, Vietnam.
The United States will no longer turn a blind eye to violations, cheating, or economic aggression.
The new TPP framework seeks to give members tariff-free trade on goods and services and includes environmental and labor rights standards. The 11 member countries include Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, Vietnam, and Japan. Japan is a huge TPP proponent as it seeks to blunt China's growing influence in the region. The TPP nations have agreed on core elements of a deal, but some Canadian resistance has slowed talks and put doubt on the TPP's survival. Canadian Minister of International Trade François-Philippe Champagne.
This is not about speed, this is about outcome. I've said to my colleague, this is not about Friday, but this is about the next decade.
For now, discussion on the TPP is a boost for the principle of multilateral trade agreements. The United States says it will continue to seek out bilateral trade deals with TPP member nations. Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba had its biggest sales day this week during Singles Day, an event that brought in a whopping $25 billion in purchases. Alibaba CEO Daniel Zhang.
We have fully experienced in one day the changes in the way consumers live.
This year's Singles Day sales went way beyond America's biggest retail days, Black Friday and Cyber Monday, which happened in late November. In 2016, both of these days combined brought in $6.79 billion. That's approximately an $18 billion difference. Zhang Jingjing is a clerk at an engineering company.
Basically, I've often emptied my shopping cart on Singles Day. I've been watching those goods for a long time, and I know very well their original prices. So I can figure out that if they have been really discounted or not.
Over 140,000 brands participated in Singles Day, with products from Japan, the U.S., Germany, Australia, and South Korea being the most popular with Chinese consumers. Chinese college students started Singles Day in the 1990s as an antidote to Valentine's Day. Now, as some estimates indicate, the middle class of the Chinese market is expected to reach over 500 million people by 2022. Retailers across the world are paying attention to the purchasing power of the world's lonely hearts. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Authorities in the southern Indian city of Hyderabad are rounding up beggars ahead of a visit by Ivanka Trump for an international conference. Over the past week, more than 200 beggars have been transported to separate male and female shelter homes located on the grounds of two city prisons. Big stories and great features come your way every day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, scientists are calling for renewed efforts to develop a vaccine for one of the biggest causes of stillbirths and infant deaths worldwide. An estimated 1 in 5 pregnant women around the world carries Group B streptococcus bacteria and shows almost no symptoms. As Henry Ridgewell reports, that can prove deadly for unborn and newborn babies, especially where traditional treatments such as antibiotics are unavailable.
Group B streptococcus bacteria can be passed to an unborn baby in the womb or to newborns during labor. Left untreated, it can cause other serious infections, such as meningitis and septicemia. Out of about 410,000 cases every year, there are at least 147,000 preventable stillbirths and infant deaths globally. Professor Joy Lawn of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine co-led the research.
That's a very conservative estimate because, in fact, in most of Asia, there is very limited data around Group B strep or indeed any infectious causes of stillbirth.
The prevalence of the Group B strep infection varies globally, ranging from 11% in Eastern Asia to 35% in the Caribbean. The United States also has a relatively large number of infections, but the number of child deaths varies according to the treatment available.
It's not the same as, you know, many conditions that we look at around the world, which are only in poor countries. But if we look at the continent that has the biggest number of cases and particularly the biggest number of deaths, that's Africa.
At least 60 countries have a policy for antibiotic use in pregnancy to tackle infection, including the United States. But in Africa, health systems can rarely afford to screen or treat Group B strep. As well as the prohibitive cost, doctors say giving antibiotics to the estimated 21.7 million pregnant women carrying the infection may contribute to antimicrobial resistance, a major global health crisis. Again, Professor Lorne.
So this new evidence that we're publishing really pushes much more clearly the urgent need for a maternal vaccine to prevent Group B strep. We must be intentional from the start that vaccine is able to reach the poorest, and especially in Africa where the burden is highest.
At least four vaccines are in development, but none is expected to be licensed for at least 5 years. Until then, the researchers say health systems should continue to treat Group B strep using antibiotics where possible. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Hybrid cars are slowly working their way into the automobile markets, and there are waiting lists for Elon Musk's new all-electric Tesla Model 3. But as popular as these cars are, they have the natural limitations of their batteries. VOA's Kevin Enix reports an answer may be in sight.
Nearly every major car manufacturer is showing off the future of the automobile, electric and hybrid cars. But the all-electric cars have a major drawback. One charge can only get you a little over 300 kilometers. Researchers in Britain are one group with new technology that could end that limitation, and there's a lot of interest in it.
We get a huge number of different customers through our doors, ranging from the extreme motorsport sort of companies through to mainstream manufacturers such as Jaguar Land Rover, Nissan, and so on. So you can imagine with a huge range of customers, there's a huge range of different requirements in terms of testing and characterization.
The team's technology is running on two tracks. The first involves creating different batteries for different needs by changing the chemicals in what the scientists call ink.
If you look at this ink is really nice consistency. It's glossy, it's homogeneous, it pours really well, which means that when we coat it on our coaters downstairs, this will give us a really nice consistent electrode.
And that ink is rolled onto sheets of copper or aluminum.
The coating machine is the first step. We apply the ink onto the foil and we dry it. And then it comes to this machine here, which is a calendaring machine. So essentially we squash down the material, we reduce the porosity, and that's how we kind of decide whether we want a high power cell or a high energy cell. So do we want to go very far or do we want to get there very quickly?
The second involves incorporating hydrogen fuel cell technology into an electric car's infrastructure.
What we would envisage in the future is a combination of an electric vehicle with its electric battery combined with a fuel cell acting as what's called a range extender. So you've got an electric vehicle that produces no emissions. When the battery gets a little bit depleted, the fuel cell would then recharge the battery, and in operating, the fuel cell produces no pollutants and so on.
And that is going to require some technology that's still on the drawing board.
So ultimately our aiming point is a battery pack, an electric vehicle, where you never have to plug in your electric vehicle. You can pick up sufficient charge as you're driving in your day-to-day activities that you'll never need to plug in ever again.
This British team says a fully electric fuel cell hybrid is still several years away. But they say the days of the internal combustion automobile are numbered. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. We're heard on great radio stations across Asia, like PSU Radio Patani FM 107.25 at Prince of Songkla University in Thailand. Thanks to everyone there and wherever you may be for listening to us today. We invite you as well to find our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. If you happen to miss part of VOA Asia, you can catch the whole thing by downloading it. And we'd like to hear from you as well. Contact us via VOA Asia Facebook or email voaasia@voanews.com. Our director is Tracy Carter. Our engineer is Patrick Daya. Managing editor, Diane Gao. And our VOA Asia team includes Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We hope you have a super day ahead.